Hi, good to have you here. My name's Keith, I'm the pastor here, and we are going to have, I think, a very interesting and informative evening. I just ask, for the sake of the evening running smoothly, that if you've got a mobile, you turn it off. That would be very much appreciated. I'm just going to read a few words from the Bible and the book of Psalms. The psalmist writes, "My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death assail me. Fear and trembling have beset me. Horror has overwhelmed me. I said, oh, that I had the wings of a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. I would flee far away and stay in the desert. I would hurry to my place of shelter, far from the tempest and the storm." The Bible is a book that deals with the nitty-gritty of the human condition. And I don't know, hopefully you've never been in the sort of situation the psalmist has been in. If we read the rest of the psalm, it's quite a desperate situation. But there have been times, I'm sure, in each of our lives where we've had trouble. And we've resorted almost to that wish fulfillment. He just wishes that he could be like a dove and fly far away from his troubles and take shelter. The dove could outfly the hawk. It could take refuge in the smallest crevice and crannies of the rock. Well, we're going to talk to Dick tonight, and we're going to see how he dealt with one particular tragedy in his life and how it's affected him since, and how it affected him at a very key time in his life when he was actually training for the Christian ministry. So I'm going to first of all, welcome you, Dick. It's great to have you with us. Dick and I know each other from, well, many years, I would say now. Dick, tell us what you're doing at the moment. Where are you at, and how far have you come, etc.?
Very nice to see you all. Thank you very much for coming out on Saturday night. I've driven up from Kent. I've been living and working in a place called Tunbridge Wells for the last 6.5 years. And I'm involved on a church staff there, and a Church of England church in Tunbridge Wells.
Okay. Was church always something in your life when you were young, or
it's just... Both my parents were churchgoers. My mum has got a very long Methodist history, and she's got a fantastic Edwardian photo of all sorts of members of the family with the, sort of the white neckerchief tied up, who are clearly sort of preachers or maybe even sort of ministers. So that goes back a long way. Dad was similarly involved. He was been involved with Freemasonry, so it was all a bit confusing as to how that sort of matched together a bit, really. But what that meant was that I got brought up attending a church. And when I was about 5 or 6, we moved from East London down to a place called Claygate in Surrey. And I remember, for some reason, as well as doing Sunday school, there was a sort of a Saturday morning Bible class that a couple of, well, I'm going to say old ladies, but they probably weren't, were they? Because you know how that sort of thing goes. And I just remember going to that as well, and just thinking they were just terrific. So, yes, church has sort of always been there for me, and a few very significant and important people along the way.
So at that young age, you were a churchgoer, but looking back on it, would you have called yourself a Christian?
I'm not sure at that point if I would have been able to tell you what I thought a Christian was, and therefore whether I was one or not, probably. After Sunday school, you graduated into boys' Bible class and girls' Bible class, and we met separately. And I remember, I guess it was one Easter time, I can't be sure about that, but the boys' Bible class was meeting, and Frank Elston, why do you remember that? Why do I remember he was called Frank Elston? But he was. He looked after us, and on the wall of the room we used to meet in, he had a sort of a cross stuck on the wall, and then he had two figures, and one figure was meant to represent sort of me, you, and the other figure was meant to represent Jesus Christ. And he said, look, because of what we've done, and because of the way in which we've behaved, because of the way in which we've treated God, because of our selfishness and our wrongdoing, we deserve to be under God's judgment. But the great Christian good news is that in his mercy, Jesus took our place. And so he took the me figure off the cross and he put the Jesus figure onto the cross. And I think that was just a great moment of revelation for me. And I look back to that as a sort of a key time. I was very fortunate in that my school had a very strong Christian presence, and it was very credible at school to be a Christian. And so that Christian Union was very supportive through those years. And I guess some of you, maybe all of you, will know the booklet Journey into Life. Does that sort of ring any bells? Mm-hmm. Being a sort of angst-ridden teenager, I used to pray the prayer at the back of Journey into Life many times, just to make sure, I guess.
I see. So it's interesting. Was it a sort of a sudden point where you definitely felt that you'd come to Christ, or was there a sort of growing process into that, or even after that?
I think the uncertainties of teenage years and the changes and challenges that you sort of go through that time constantly put sort of seeds of doubt into your head, and you need the reassurance of the Journey to Life prayer or the friends at School Christian Union, because there wasn't really much happening at church at that point. But that happened a bit later again, which I was very grateful for.
So you were sort of very much part of the church and doing things in the church, and no doubt part of church youth groups. And
well, there wasn't a church youth group at that point.
No. Okay.
All there was a, once you got confirmed, which is a sort of Anglican version of adult membership, that's probably the easiest way to describe it. That was really a way of getting out of children's stuff, but not necessarily into anything else. But church began a monthly breakfast after an early communion service. And amazingly, a few young people did go along to that. And so that was just happening. And then one year from that, somebody said that they were going to start a Bible study that Sunday evening in their home. They just moved into the village from somewhere else. And if anyone would like to come, we could go along. And so five of us went on to that Bible study on that Sunday night. I think I must have been about, that has been lower six, so just after GCSEs, that sort of time probably.
So did you go from there to university, college, that kind of?
Yeah, had a year out. Worked. My father was sort of work up in London. I went and worked for him for a year, which was terrific. Mm. Went off to university in Exeter, and had a great time down there.
Okay. Were you connected with the church then?
Yes, there was. My hall of residence was way over one side of town, and the sort of the Bible believing and Bible teaching Anglican church was right over the other side. So being lazy students, you can imagine what our conclusion was. And it was justified by not just being a long way away, but the organist couldn't play and the vicar had a funny voice. That's good reasons for attending somewhere or not, isn't it? So we didn't go there to start with, went to a church in town. But then I was quite keen on a girl at one point, so she went there, so I thought, oh, well, I better go there instead and see what happens. So I tried that, and I did end up staying on there, and I ended up getting very involved with youth work there and various other things there. So that was a very significant spiritual home for some time.
What happened after college after that, then?
After college, I went off. I worked for a year after college, and then was getting ready to go off to theological college and to get married. But basically, somebody hadn't quite kept on top of the paperwork. Does that happen in your office or your home? Easily done, isn't it? So I got a place at a college to go and get sort of trained for Church of England ministry. I was just about to get married. We got a house to move to and all that sort of thing. And then when I got in touch with the people who are supposed to be making sure all that happened, they said, oh, sorry, your sort of accreditation ran out 6 months ago. So that was a little bit of a crisis, really. That was quite exciting. But it got sorted out in due time.
Just backtracking, there's a couple of interesting things there. How did you first feel called to the ministry? What sort of convinced you that this is what you wanted to do with your life? Was there a dramatic calling, or was it just a process where you sort of sought it through, or friends said things to you, or whatever?
I went to a school's career interview when I was about 13 or 14. I can't remember exactly when. And the master running it said, OK, well, what do you want to do then? And I said, I want to be a vicar. He said, don't be stupid. Go away and read Cowan's Institutes and then tell me you want to be a vicar. Cowan's Institutes, as you don't know, is sort of a very big, fat book. Two volumes, very big, fat book. Great book. Mm. He didn't mean it like that at all. He meant that'll put you off. That was his sort of intention. And then, subsequent to that, the youth group that grew dramatically from those sort of five of us, we were having an Easter sort of house party. We were down in Kent at a place called Herne Bay Court. And I went on that thinking I was working in London. That was my sort of year off between school and university. And I was thinking it was about time I had a chat with my manager to see if they might be interested in sort of some sort of sponsorship thing through university and maybe having me back afterwards, because I was very excited by the City of London. I liked the sort of atmosphere and all that was going on. I thought that'd be a terribly exciting place to work. The guy who was running the youth group, he worked for Shell, a big oil company. And I thought, yeah, that's a reasonable thing to do, isn't it? So sort of do some Christian stuff and have a nice job as well. That'll be a good combination. But by the time I came back from that youth week, I can't remember how long we were there for, my mind had been completely changed. And all thoughts of going to work in the city or going to talk to my departmental manager had sort of disappeared out the back door. And there was only one thing that I was sort of wanted to do or focused on. And so that was sort of lower six before going off to university. I went to see my sort of local vicar. He was a bit confused, didn't quite know. And various things sort of just progressed a bit after that. And I think I can honestly say there's nothing I have wanted to do other than what I am doing since then. I wouldn't mind being a sports commentator, but that never quite opened up. So there we go.
You also mentioned that by the time you were ready for theological college, that you were married at that point, and
just about to get married. We
just
got married
about
then.
Just about to get married.
Just
okay.
About to get married.
So,
yep.
How did you meet your wife? And
as I said, there were five of us at that initial youth group meeting. A week or two later, another sort of bunch turned up because of contacts through sort of uniform organisations or something. I can't quite remember. And Diana was one of those. So we met through the youth group in our lower six year.
Okay. So how long was the courtship?
That's a very interesting question. I think it'd be fair to say that she wasn't the slightest bit interested in me.
I know the theory. Tracy wasn't interested in me, but I can understand that.
Very good taste. Very good taste. We ended up going to the same university together, but that was sort of just one of those things. After university, she went to work in Japan for a mission agency called the Church Missionary Society. And during her time in Japan, we started writing to each other. And it was really through writing to each other that the relationship sort of grew and developed. And she came back from Japan, and we got married sort of the next summer, effectively.
Okay, so had you just started at theological?
No, not yet. I was finishing off in Exeter at that point.
Okay, yeah. Right. So what happened when you went to theological college? What was Diane doing? Was she supporting you to get you through that? Or?
She spent She worked the first year. I think she worked as a travel agent selling foreign exchange. I seem to remember that. Mm-hmm. But she was pretty good on the catering front, and so the person responsible for all the catering at the Theological College, she stopped that sort of next summer, and Diana applied for the job and got it. So she was actually catering manager at the training college thereafter.
Mm. That's incredible. Yeah. Mm. When my brother was going through theological training, his wife was supporting him. He had no grant. Mm. And ironically, the position of cook and caretaker came up, and they were able to support themselves as his wife became the cook, he became the caretaker. Mm. So they actually ended up going through college and actually having some savings left, which they never thought they would have. Yes. So
I was nowhere near qualified enough to be a caretaker.
So no.
Forget that.
Well, they did say the first time they had to cook for a conference at LTS, as it was Kensett then. It was near disastrous. People were waiting for their next course. So you grow into these things. How did you find the process of training for the ministry? I mean, did you ever have to read Calvin's Institute from cover to cover? Not that's a bad
sadly,
thing.
Sadly, we weren't made to read it, which would have done us a world of good, really. It was a Church of England training college, so it was pretty mixed. Although it was meant to be an evangelical training college, it did the training with a higher church college and a couple of liberal colleges as well. So it was pretty mixed. I was playing quite a lot of sport at that time, so I enjoyed playing sport, and there was student work to get involved with as well. And so they were the sort of the really good bits, and also some great people, friends from the college at the time as well.
Okay. As you sort of approached your last year, I suppose really, you know, life must have been seen to go quite smoothly. I don't know how you were academically, but were the results coming in okay?
That was pretty much okay. We'd already got, I got my sort of first job, as it were, in the sort of end of September, beginning of October. So yeah, we knew exactly what was lying ahead of us and so what was going to happen next.
You were sort of having all the apprehensions or I don't know.
I think it was excitement, really. Excitement, I think you look probably forward to getting right out of college, really. It's only meant to be a bit of a staging post. So, yes, there was a university mission in the town we were in coming up in the February. So we were very much looking forward to that. And I was involved in organising some of the Christians in Sport sort of stuff around that. So that was the sort of the main focus of the year, having got a job, I guess.
It's interesting you should say that. So there you are, this point. You've been married now for about 2.5 years. I know, because you told me you were very much in love with Diane. She was very much in love with you. You've got your whole life ahead of you in ministry, and you're looking forward to it, a sense of excitement. And then what can only really be described as a catastrophic event happened. Would you tell us about that, Dick?
I'd been in Sheffield on a course, and Diana's parents had left Claygate and moved to the West Country, to a place called Winchcombe, which is out near Cheltenham, Gloucester, Cheltenham direction. And she'd gone from Cambridge to there at the end of term, and I went down to Winchcombe after the end of my course in Sheffield. And I think it was probably the second or third day we were down there, and we thought we'd go for a walk, nice winter afternoon, and we had a choice. We could either go up onto Cleve Hill Golf Course, which overlooks the race course, where there'll be lots of action next week. And we walked out there before, and that was a really nice place to walk. Or, and this is what we decided to do, we could sort of wander around some of the hamlets sort of near Winchcombe itself. And that was what we chose to do. And we were walking back into the village. And it was duskish, I guess. And just because of the way in which the main road back into the village went, instead of walking facing the traffic, we were walking with our backs to the traffic, and we were hit from behind by a car. I have no recollection of anything after that than waking up in Cheltenham General, although I am told people who came to help at the roadside asked me who we were and where we were staying, and I was able to tell them my in-law's address. Diana suffered head injuries in the sort of collision, and she was taken to a hospital in Bristol. And as far as I still don't, this sounds terrible, doesn't it? I don't actually know which day she died on. So just before Christmas, she died in Frenchay in Bristol. And at the time I was in Cheltenham General.
Well, I don't think it is surprising. You can't really put things together at that time. So you were still in hospital when you were told, or
Yes, somebody who I had met briefly, I think. He'd come and done something at college while I was training. He was working, I think, in Cheltenham or Gloucester at the time, and he came and told me what had happened. Yeah.
What was your initial thought?
Well, that's quite difficult because I got sort of serious injury to the back of my left leg, but surface injury, nothing sort of major in terms of muscle or bone. But I think I was drugged up to the eyeballs, probably. Mm. So, to be honest, I haven't got a clue my reaction was.
How did this event sort of develop then? I mean, it was an awful event. How were you feeling emotionally when you were sort of discharged and you had the whole situation now? I mean, I can't even start to think about it, but, you know, what are you going to do? What's going to happen with your training? Where are you going to do? Do you need time out? What sort of things were happening? What did you decide to do? Or how did you cope with it?
One of the interesting things in terms of college life at that point was that there had been two previous tragic deaths in the previous couple of years. There was a Nigerian family who were driving up the M11. Their son was asleep on the back seat of the car and they were hit from behind. And just because of the nature of the collision and how he was lying, he broke his neck and didn't wake up. So there was their grief. And then somebody, a couple who I'd known very well in Exeter days, we'd done a lot together in the church that we attended. He was a year ahead of me. He got a job in Birmingham. His wife had gone up for an interview for a teaching job in Birmingham, and she was involved in an accident on the way back to Cambridge from Birmingham, and she died in Edinburgh's hospital sort of the summer before. And certainly I'd remembered saying to Diana that I hadn't got a clue how Nick was coping following Sarah's death. And of course then a few months later, 6 months later, I'm exactly in the middle of the same situation myself, and you're suddenly discovering the sort of the power and the care that God has for you in those sort of situations. There was a funeral service nearby. I can't remember exactly where it was held, but near Cheltenham, fairly quickly. And I remember going to that, sort of in my hospital sort of kit, as it were. I then went back to my parents in Claygate, ended up having to have a skin graft because the wound on the back of my leg went sort of septic and had to be sort of dealt with. So a lot of my time was taken up with sort of getting better. Yeah. But it was also very good being back in Claygate, because that was where sort of friends we'd grown up with still were. And therefore, it was very good to be able to spend time with people who had known us both for many years. And there was no messing about, if you see what I mean. There was no sort of need to pretend with them, because we'd all grown up through all sorts of things together, and they were just the right people to be around at that particular moment.
Did you find it helped that there had been sort of, in a sense, it sounds strange, but this small community in the college that had been through a tough time, and perhaps, you know, the people around were more aware or in tuned to grief? And
I got back to Cambridge just before that sort of mission, university mission, happened. And again, that was terrific, because although I had a sort of walkie stick at the start of the week, I just got sort of swept along, and I spent some time with the guy doing the Christian support stuff during that. And so that was a very good re-entry. You will know, I'm sure, that grief is quite an individual thing. And we all tend to grieve in our own way. And I think being sort of the third in line, if I can put it rather crudely like that, sort of standards had been set by the previous situations. And I vividly remember climbing a staircase to go and see somebody, and I was just about to knock on the door when there was obviously two people in the room, and one of them said, "How do you think Dick's doing?" And the reply was something like, "Well, to see him, you probably wouldn't know anything had happened." Which simply said, I was grieving very differently from how the others sort of had, and we will all do that. So it probably won't surprise you to hear I didn't knock on the door. I just went back downstairs at that particular moment. So yes, there was just there was lots of sorting out to do in terms of what was I still going to have to do at college and what wasn't going to have to do. I got back in touch with the church that had offered me a job and said, look, it's now me on my own, do you still want me? All those sorts of things. There was sorting out to be done as well. Yep.
But that's interesting because it seems to me that you said two things you sort of raised there is one, you sounded very determined to sort of still get on, but obviously to clear with the church what they were expecting. But the other thing you said is that's when God's care and love kicks in. How are you aware of that in what, you know, truly an awful event?
Obviously, one of the things one has to do at Theological College is to write essays about pastoral situations. And one of the essays I'd had to write was on helping people, or what would be likely to help people in bereavement. And I guess it probably won't surprise you to know that a lot of the things that I had written in the essay about, just for a Christian being certain of their eternal future and confident in everything that Jesus has done for them, and knowing that God is both in charge of everything and also a loving and caring God in all circumstances, they were the sort of things that got crosses and red lines through them in the essay. But of course, those were the things that were absolutely the most important and significant and comforting things when it actually came to it. So the fact that I knew that Diana was safe and secure with Jesus was an enormous comfort. The fact that I had a confidence that God has everything in his hands and is sovereign over all circumstances and all situations was a huge comfort, because I wasn't left sort of wondering if this was some sort of vaguely random thing and therefore why on earth it had happened and all those sorts of things. And the promise that God's comfort and strength will be sufficient. And of course, my question to Diana about not wondering how Nick was coping was a real question, but there was obviously going to be no answer to that question until I needed the answer, if you see what I mean. It was only once I had experienced that that loss that I knew what God had in store and how he could meet needs and provide sufficiently for that.
Well, we'd make no mistake in thinking there was still a grieving process, a very necessary one.
Absolutely. And again, just as everybody grieves differently, you can't sort of manufacture a process or hasten a process. You will have heard that there are different sort of stages of grief. But again, that's just a general pattern. I consider myself very fortunate in that I didn't go through any sort of anger at all in my sort of grieving state process, call it what you like. But that's just a sort of a time issue, and God sees you through.
So how long was it before you took up the post at the church? Presumably they still wanted you to go there. How long sort of from Diana's death to getting back into circulation and going there?
That was Diana died sort of Christmas time, 82, and I pitched up at the church sometime in September. I'm not exactly sure when.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break there and have some refreshments. And then I'm going to come back and we're going to look at the rest of Dick's very eventful life and what happened in his ministry and what indeed's happened since with family and other things. But I'm just going to say grace and then it's next door. Okay? Let's just say give thanks. Gracious Lord, we do thank you for Dick's candour and his honesty. And Lord, we pray that as we have the rest of this evening, that again, this might be of help to each one of us. And now, Lord, we thank you for the provision of food. We thank you for those who've also prepared us as well. Amen. Before we do anything else, I think it would be good to particularly give a round of applause to those who've catered so adequately for us today. Let's go back to life since that traumatic event and the death of your wife, Diana. After that, you're now in ministry. Did you find what you'd been through added a dimension? One of the things you said was you'd written these essays and you'd done the stuff. And although this was stuff that maybe didn't get the highest marks, it was the stuff that you really drew on. How did you find that when you were out in the nitty-gritty of dealing with folk?
I think when you've been through what is, after all, a very common experience, that is... bereavement, it does give you a natural connection with others who are doing that. But obviously, in a sense, each bereavement is different. And so you can't impose your experience on other people, let alone your reactions on other people. So in terms of sort of empathy and just understanding where people were, I think it was hugely helpful. After my father died, the next funeral I took after my father died, I was absolutely outraged because the person I was burying on that occasion had lived 2 or 3 years longer than my father. And that was a reaction I wasn't anticipating that at all, but that was a very sort of strange reaction to that sort of particular thing.
So there were things perhaps hitting you that you hadn't really sort of, well, until they happened, you didn't really see them coming.
Yes, I think the other thing from my wife's death, I took a wedding for somebody in the youth group back at Claygate. It must have been within the year or 18 months. And when we got to the till death us do part section of the vows, I found that was quite a hard thing to say, because I guess I'd begun to appreciate what that actually meant, whereas it had just tripped off the tongue rather easily before, I think.
Yeah, so these things sort of come and hit you, and did you find, even after a time, I mean, I've known several bereavements in my family, and one of the things I've discovered is that you can be quite a long way down the road and then suddenly someone says something and, you know, nothing that they intend to, they don't know it's going to trigger a reaction, but it goes away and you suddenly find yourself sort of thrown back into something you thought you were through. Did you find that particularly?
In many ways you can prepare yourself for the things you think you're going to find difficult, like anniversaries, birthdays, you know, meeting members of the family, that sort of thing. So therefore, it almost goes without saying that the things that catch you out are the things you're not prepared for, and the things just come from nowhere. And it could just be sort of a view, it could be a comment, it could be a song, it could be a smell, it could be anything, couldn't it? That just brings back that sort of poignancy and that reminder. And I think one of the lessons I have learned over the years is that that can go on for an awfully long time. And I can think of somebody who's in one of the churches where I was in village ministry in Essex, and every time we sang a particular hymn on a Sunday, she would burst into tears. And this was years and years and years and years after her husband died. But that was the reality. Because you don't forget people, and therefore you're left with that sort of that residue and all the responses that that go with that.
Now, I know it sounds a bit strange, but your life has moved on. Ministry's moved on. And Tracy and I know, because we've known you for some time, that you've been extremely happily married to Suzanne. Now, how far on were you from Diane's death? And how did it feel when you suddenly realised that you might be forming a romantic attachment again? Because that must be a bit weird, you know, in some ways.
It's very interesting. One of the things that I've discovered over the years is that very often an early thought for the bereaved person is, will I marry again? And it's been a great help to be able to sort of say to people, no, that's not disloyal, that's not sort of odd, that's not unspiritual. That's just some sort of gut human reaction, because as I've talked to people, that seems to be quite a common reaction, but as I say, not very easily acknowledged. I did go and see my youth leader and said, look, should I not pursue marriage? Should I accept that singleness is going to be better? And within Church of England circles, some of our sort of heroes of recent years, like John Stott and Dick Lucas and Jonathan Fletcher, have all been single. So there were some very good models out there. My youth leader's advice was that as most members of congregations are likely to be married, then it was probably better to be married because you would be identifying with them in a very easy sort of way. So that was helpful. I think I was also helped by the fact that my mother-in-law, she said, we very much hope and expect you will get married again. So that sort of permission was very sort of helpful. And I think that allied to the fact that I tend to look forward rather than backwards. So I'm always excited about the next thing and the next possibility. And so therefore, I tend to sort of leave the past behind. I'm sure some people would say far too easily. So I could easily think myself into what that might be or how it might look. Mm-hmm. So there was somebody who I'd been quite sort of friendly with and quite keen on when I was at university. She was in North London at the time, and I saw her a sort of a couple of times. There was somebody who I knew through my Exeter connections who was working for Scripture Union. I saw her a couple of times. And that was within the sort of the 9 months sort of mark, 9 months to a year mark, I suppose, after Diana had died. Mm. But I actually, Suzanne was on the sort of youth team at the church I went to do my sort of curacy in, and she had worked out that everybody would assume that everybody else would invite me for lunch on my first Sunday. And because everybody assumed everybody else would, nobody did. And of course, she was absolutely right, nobody did. So she had me around for lunch with a bunch of other youth leaders, and it was terrific. It was particularly terrific because it was in the days when ITV used to show live First Division football matches on a Sunday afternoon. Now, some of you probably think that's appalling, watching TV on a Sunday afternoon, but as us Anglicans, we do that sort of thing. And it was Spurs against Nottingham Forest. So we'd had lunch, everybody went to wash up and be friendly and chat, and me and another guy sat in front of the football, and he and I are lifelong friends, and not looked back, really. So she made a very wise choice in that regard. So that was how we met. And I think... When do we... We must have started going out in the new year, I can't quite remember, so that was sort of... Was it New Year or was it Easter? I can't, honestly, I'm hopeless at dates, things like that. It's just terrible, isn't it? But I can't remember.
And how long was the courtship? I mean, was it sort of fairly, once you'd sort of taken the plunge, was it sort of, well,
I arrived,
this is it?
I arrived in Cot Foster's in September 83. And I think we got married April 85. I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's close as I can do it.
Dates aren't your strongest point, are they?
I was a historian as well, so that's quite embarrassing. Okay.
Just broadening it out a bit, Dick. There's no doubt that you've been through what most people would say is a very traumatic time, very difficult time. But another question would be, with sort of acts like that, in some way we can understand them, human error, which causes other people suffering. But looking at a bigger question, how can we square that? And you were saying, you know, early on that you believe in a God who's sovereign. In other words, he controls. There aren't random events. Mm. How do we square that with things like natural disasters? You know, terrible things which seem to just sweep many people away.
It's part of our human condition to want answers to things, isn't it? We like to be able to explain things and nail things down. And when it comes to this whole sort of issue of suffering, we probably have to say, look, we don't have all the answers. But in a sense, the Bible does give us a good number of answers. And I guess one of the Bible's big answers to why on earth is there evil and suffering in the world, why do things go wrong, is because way back right at the very beginning, the first human beings chose to rebel against God's rule and disobeyed the word that he'd given them and decided that they'd be much better off if they lived under their own rules rather than under God's rules. And as a result of which, their relationship with him was broken, their relationship with one another was broken, their relationship with the world itself was broken, and the world itself was broken. And that brokenness is what results in all the evils and difficulties and disasters that we suffer from today. So man's inhumanity to man comes from that. We see the injustices in our world, don't we? We see the barbaric terrorist outrages committed by ISIS and others. But you step back from that and say, but the floods and the tsunamis and the earthquakes and the famines come from the fact that the world is broken, and that rebellion affected all aspects of our relationships and all aspects of life in the universe. And so therefore, there's no sort of straight line in terms of deserving something. So why have I got cancer? Why did my dad die of cancer? Well, it's not because he did X, Y, or Z. That happens to be the way the world is because of mankind's initial rebellion against God. And that is why we suffer and we struggle. That's why we die and get ill and relationships break down.
Mm. You've been very candid, Dick. I think everyone's appreciated the way that you've spoken very openly about these things. Could you, and you've touched on the fact that, you know, you believe in a God who's loving, he has a love towards you, and he has a concern that people should come to know him. Would you please sort of just speak very freely now about why you can believe that? Where do you find that?
I mean, in a sense, there's a one-word answer to that question. And that one word is Jesus. Jesus was a human being. The Bible tells us that he was God in human form. And he walked the country lanes of Palestine at the beginning of what we call AD. And Jesus experienced suffering. He knew what it was to lose a father. He knew what it was to confront disease and sickness. He knew what it was to weep at the grave of his friend Lazarus. Jesus knew what it was just to live as an ordinary human being with all the struggles and sufferings of daily life. But Jesus didn't come into the world just to identify with human struggle. He came into the world to solve the problem. And he did that by going through unbelievable suffering in himself, both in terms of the physical effects of the Roman death of crucifixion, and also the effects of the scourging with the Roman whips. If you've seen the film The Passion of the Christ, you've got a sense of what that was like. But in a sense, that physical suffering, while it was real and as bad as it is, that wasn't the end, or in a sense the sort of the climax of the suffering that Jesus endured. Because he took on himself God's just judgment and punishment for our sinfulness and wrongdoing. When I said the picture we had in that upper room at church with the cross on the wall and the two figures, when Jesus died on the cross, he didn't just die a physical death on the cross, he died a death bearing the weight of God's judgment and punishment on our rebellion and sinfulness. And that resulted in him being separated from his Father. And it was that sort of spiritual suffering, if we can put it in those terms, which is sort of uncapturable on film, but also unimaginable. And so that was the lengths to which Jesus was prepared to go in order to suffer for us on our behalf and in our place. He did that quite willingly. And we also know that he did it triumphantly, because in 2 weeks' time we'll be celebrating not just Jesus' death on the Friday, but we'll be celebrating his resurrection on the Sunday. And that conquering of death, that defeating of death, gives all people who trust in Jesus a great and a sure and a certain hope. Because we know, don't we, that this world is not as it should be. We want it to be better. And as we rail against pain and suffering and injustice in our world, we're simply saying there's got to be something better than this. And that's a right sense. The problem is we want to make that world now. We try to make that world now. Whereas Jesus died on the cross for that future world. The wife of our assistant at Tunbridge Wells, she's in her mid-30s probably. She has suffered from liver cancer for some time. And just listen to her testimony again the other day. She was talking about seeing the life she lives now as what she calls her sort of spare life. If you understand ten-pin bowling, you get a spare if you get a strike, don't you? If you're watching the sort of T20 Cricket World Cup, you know, if they bowl you a no ball, you get a free hit. And it's as though this is her sort of free hit life. She could easily have died a few years ago from the cancer. She didn't. And I think I have a similar experience, don't I? It could have been me who died in that accident and not Diana. This is sort of a spare life. I've got a bit of a free hit life to enjoy now. But in the end, real life is coming. That's the great Christian hope. That's what the resurrection tells us. In a sense, that's what we yearn for when we have every sense that what's going on now isn't right. It should be better, and yet it will be better because Jesus has died. He secured that to that next world. Let me just read you a little bit from the last book of the Bible that talks about that next world. Then I saw a heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven, the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. And they will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." Don't we long for a life without tears, without death, without mourning, without crying, without pain? Well, God has dealt with all of those things. God's love means that because Jesus has suffered, there's a time coming when we won't suffer, when we will be in a new world, free of all those things. And that's the promise that the sovereign God of the universe makes to his people, and a promise that he delivered in the Lord Jesus, who died on the cross for us, who rose again from the dead, and promises to be with us in that new heaven and new earth forever.
Dick, thanks very much. We have a few minutes. If anyone has a question, Dick is very willing to answer it. Well, if that's the case, all that remains to say is that we have Dick preaching for us tomorrow morning at 10:30. He'll be continuing the theme that he's touched on there, the hope that those who believe in the Lord have. And we'd just like to stress that we, as we enter the Easter period, I'll be talking on the sufferings of Christ, the necessity of that, and the hope that that brings. And after Easter, as a church, I'm going to be doing a series, probably for about a month, looking at some of the Psalms, looking at those great dialogues where people have questions of God. They're struggling with God. They're not always understanding what God's doing. And we'll be looking at those in our morning services as well as touching on the wider issue of suffering through natural events and the suffering that man causes man. We'll be doing a bit of that as well. But I would urge you, anyone who wants to, we have free booklets at the back. The subject of suffering is tackled in a great deal of detail by a guy called John Blanchard, this book, Where is God When Things Go Wrong? A very well written book. A book that I have given to many people, and quite a few have got back to me and said how helpful they have found it. So whether you're a Christian struggling with these issues, or someone who wouldn't call yourself a Christian yet but has questions, this isn't a big read. And do yourself a favour. Read it. My contact is in there if you want to contact me about anything. I don't just come in and preach at you. I can listen. And do feel free to take that away. And Dick, I'd like to thank you very much. I don't know how I feel talking about some of the issues you've touched on tonight, but I think we all appreciate Dick's honesty. And as I said, tomorrow he'll be talking again, and I know joyously, because you and me, we think it's a privilege, don't we, to teach the gospel on the great hopes that there are found in God's word. The Bible is a realistic book. Dick will be dealing with that, but talking about the great hope as well. Well, thank you, Dick. Thanks ever so much. Can we thank him and show our appreciation? Dick is around if you want to corner him and ask a question, whatever. But do feel free. There are books, as I said, these books, other books. It's all free. Lovely to see you. Thank you for coming out tonight. It's been very much appreciated, and we've enjoyed meeting with you. Thank you. Thanks, Dick.